I'm Brian McKellen of Speaking Out for the Blind. There's a couple of ways to tune into the show. Dial 605-475-8130 on any phone, then press 1 at the prompt. You may also go to acbradio.org/mainstream and tap on one of the Click Here to Listen links. Enjoy! Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind on ACB Radio. I'm Brian McKellen. This show airs every Wednesday at 10:30 p.m. Eastern. Now on to the show. Today's guest is Lori Rubin. You may remember her from a previous show with her as a famous opera star. Lori's blindness hasn't stopped her from achieving success. In fact, she's written a new musical. It's called Peace on Your Wings. Peace tells about a girl's dreams for a better tomorrow. The girl's dreams teach the world about courage and, yes, peace. Lori is here to talk more about this groundbreaking play. Welcome back, Lori.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Brian.
Just to refresh our listeners' memories.
Sure.
For those who haven't listened to the show before, tell us briefly about your vision loss in your opera career.
Okay, well, I was blind since birth, and I have Leber's congenital amaurosis, which means that my retina's never developed. So I've always, known the world as a blind person, except that I do see light, a light and shadows and that's about it. But I've never seen that as a dark life or anything. I've just always seen that as that's how my world has been. And that's pretty much it.
How did you decide to get into plays and do Peace on Your Wings?
It's kind of an interesting story. My background is in singing, but a few years ago, I did a piece called Do You Dream in Color? I was singing a lot of new music at the time in New York City, and this one composer asked me to write a poem about my blindness, and then he would set it to music. So that was my first time writing lyrics for myself. After that experience, which was so rewarding, my wife and I started writing music together. She's a composer, and I would write lyrics. And so we actually worked on an album, and I think that's the last time that we spoke was what we were in the middle of working on this pop album together. And then sort of our musical collaboration sort of just took a change in a way, because we had an opportunity to write a musical. There was an organization here on island that we worked closely with that was interested in having us tour our productions to the neighbor islands, because Jenny and also we also run a program called Ohana Arts, and it's a performing arts program for youth ages 6 to 18, and we put on main stage musicals every year. So we had an opportunity to tour a musical, and we were given $30,000. And that was when Jenny said, "Well, why don't we write something? We have this opportunity." And so that's when we decided to write this musical together, and we had already worked together as composer and lyricist. So it was kind of a natural progression.
Wait, Jenny, you mean Jenny Tyra?
Yep, Jenny Tyra. Uh-huh.
Tyra, okay. I understand that you were the lyricist and you were also the associate artistic director. How did you play both of these roles blind?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, most of that kind of, fortunately, when you're doing this kind of a role in a nonprofit, you don't necessarily need to have vision. It's all about, for me, it's chutzpah, because you have to do a lot of calling, you have to do a lot of emailing and a lot of prospecting funders and recruiting children. And so it takes a lot of people skills. And I think because of being blind and because I always say that the role as an educator, as a blind person, is almost as a psychologist. You have to make people feel comfortable with you, and in an extra layer as a blind person, because they're already a little bit thrown off by the lack of eye contact and the not knowing what to expect. And so I think for me, in a way, those skills had been more developed because of kind of over the years, the trial and error and having to deal with that. And Jenny is, she's, Jenny Tyra is the executive director, and she does a lot of the visual stuff. She does web design, and she does a lot of the graphics. She used to do our programs and our posters, and I'll send her like a document, like a grant, and I'll be like, how does this look? And she'll be like, oh, horrible. Let me respace it. So fortunately, you know, we work together, and I'm sure there's, and I do have to say that I'm sure there are blind people who are much better than I am at formatting and spacing and making things look pretty. But, those are not my top skills as an associate artistic director.
It's inspired by the life story of Sadako Sakaki. Who's Miss Sakaki?
Oh, Sadako Sasaki? She was a 12-year-old girl who got leukemia because from the radiation from the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. She was only 11 years old when she was diagnosed, and she passed away at age 12. But what made her famous was the fact that she folded 1,000 paper cranes, which to fulfill a Japanese legend stating that if you fold 1,000 paper cranes that you will be granted a wish. And so she really, her charm, I think, really got not just her, but everybody in the hospital and her friends and everybody folding cranes. And it was a very, I think that's what inspired her friends once she died to get a monument built in her name. And, you know, people think of this, oh, wow, what a sad story to turn into a musical. But Sadako, as you do research on her, you find that she's actually quite positive and everybody loved her and her legacy lives on. I mean, that's really who she was. And what makes her so special is that she became an international leader of world peace without even really knowing it. And the crane became a symbol of international world peace. And her friends became these ambassadors for peace. They were only 11, 12 years old. And here, you know, you don't associate that kind of rallying support to get a monument built by, you don't think of that when it comes to children. And I think that's what makes this production so exciting and so uplifting and so moving forward rather and to the future. You know, you get that sense rather than this just being a story about somebody who passed away from a tragic disease.
They made the origami birds out of needle wrappings and scraps, right?
That's right, because they didn't really have the money to go looking for origami paper. I mean, these were kids who were poor. Hiroshima was devastated by the atomic bombings. And so, yeah, any paper they could get their hands on, they did. And it was, and they folded. And it's quite beautiful because you can see different sizes and different colors. And certainly, as you said, different needle wrappings and medicine labels. So it's really interesting and historical in that way.
Unfortunately, Sadako, yes, she died at the age of 12. She didn't get her wish granted. How'd she die? Was it indeed leukemia that took her life?
Yeah, it was leukemia. I think that in a way, and yes, she didn't get her wish in terms of, you know, she wasn't, literally, she did not live past, you know, age 12. But she's become so immortalized by these cranes that in a way they did, the cranes did in a way get her wish, because she and her story and her wish for peace have been pervading symbols, I think, through the last several decades.
What have the effects been since Sadako's story has symbolized the peace movement? How has it symbolized the peace movement around the world? Any sort of stories you could tell us?
The most amazing story that I heard was Sadako's roommate in the hospital. Her name was Kyo Okuda, and Kyo was a couple years older than Sadako, but she actually made it. She made it out of the hospital because she just had radiation sickness and was cured. And when she left the hospital, she became a peace advocate. And she went to Iraq during Desert Storm. And she said she was floored because all of these children in Iraq were folding cranes. And she couldn't believe it. She's like, she couldn't believe that these kids knew who Sadako was. To me, that's an amazing sort of example of how Sadako's story has really moved beyond Japan and beyond her family and her friends. And that these kids during Desert Storm were demonstrating for world peace by folding cranes. And actually some of them were drawing pictures of Sadako as well. So maybe in a way, you know, Sadako was, you know, a voice for these kids. It kind of gave them hope because she was a child like they were. And so maybe she inspired the young generations to think of a peace, more peaceful world, even in war-torn countries.
Peace on Your Wings not only addresses peace in the world, but also addresses some of the universal themes being played out in today's society. The transition from elementary to middle school, self-identity, and even more importantly, bullying. How does the musical address these issues?
So what we did with the musical was, when we were deciding about it, a lot of these initial ideas were Jenny's ideas. And, you know, I didn't really know much about Sadako's story, because actually she had read a children's book called Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. And that's actually how, you know, most children know about this story. And it's pretty much a book that sort of is semi-biographical, but there's also some fictional elements to the story as well. But as we were thinking about this, and as we were actually more intrigued by her true story, we thought, well, you know, one of the things that we should do is tell a story about her friends, because the friends are the ones who got the monument built. And so I think, in a way, in order to make Sadako, her story, more symbolic of peace and also, you know, living life to the fullest every day that you have, you know, we decided to come up, and mostly, and it's actually really, it was Jenny's idea, was to come up with a fictional story of her friends, because we didn't know much about her actual friends, and so we fictionalized them. And we did know that they had remorse once she had passed away. So to get there, you know, we created all these stories of, you know, why would they not visit her in the hospital? Like, they became too involved with their own lives in junior high. They became too involved with boys, or too involved with, like, not liking each other anymore because of whatever. Like, they were growing distant and stuff. So those kinds of things, you know, we felt are so relevant to kids today. And it was so important to us that, you know, middle schoolers today would go and watch the show and not think of it as, oh, this is not my time, this is from the 1950s. We wanted them to relate to these stories. And so that's essentially how it all started. So we built several subplots from her friends, several different little sub-stories that, you know, and also that also helps to keep the play amusing, because, you know, every other scene is in the hospital. So then if we take it out of the hospital and you have these kids, you know, with their antics and like all these things that happen, it keeps the story, it keeps the play moving and uplifting and lighthearted in that way.
I understand that. What's also unique about the show is that it speaks out to issues that haven't been represented so far in musical theater. What are the issues?
When you think of musical theater, well, there's actually not a huge culture of Asian history or stories or characters being portrayed in musical theater. So we were really excited because, you know, we work mostly with Asian students. Hawaii is predominantly Asian. It's sort of a microcosm of different Asian cultures. And we've seen firsthand how even in Hawaii, our students get discriminated against for roles in their own school plays, because if it's, you know, Legally Blonde, they're obviously not going to be, you know, they're not going to be Legally Blonde. But even in other plays, they sometimes are shunted aside for opportunities. And we thought, oh my gosh, like, these are such talented kids. We need to expand the repertoire so that there's absolutely no excuse and that they get the opportunity to play roles that they deserve. And so, you know, it's not like an issue that's talked about in the show, because, you know, there's no need for that. The show represents these underrepresented Asian youth. And the other thing is that there's not a whole lot of musical theater out there representing youth, period. And we wanted a show that was completely told through youth. So Peace on Your Wings kind of allowed us that idea, because Sadako's story is all about youth and these children ambassadors. We were determined to make the show challenging, you know, in terms of harmony. They have four-part harmonies in a lot of the songs. We wanted it emotionally challenging. And of course, you know, dealing with death is definitely emotional. And we wanted it to be real to their experience, because when you're having kids in most plays, they're having to play adults. And kids are just as emotionally deep, but they have not had the same level of life experience that adults have had. So, you know, we wanted to create the emotional range at the level of life experience that these kids had. And also, we wanted a fully orchestrated score. So Jenny had orchestrated this gorgeous, oh my gosh, beautiful, orchestrated, very lush landscape of music with strings and French horn and clarinet, and at the same time we have a couple of rock songs, and we have bass and guitar and saxophone, and we incorporate like 50s music in it. We incorporate Japanese taiko, so there's a lot incorporated in this play to represent the youth, and also the culture of the 50s and the culture of I would say our Japanese culture.
Were any of the kids nervous during the auditions, Or did any of them get emotional at all when they were doing the play, especially on the subject matter? Because you did mention kids' emotions, and also we're talking about something, a huge event in history that was probably one of the saddest.
Yeah. Yeah, the kids got emotional, but during the audition, they were, I think, they, you know, they had known us for years as their teachers. So I think a lot of them were skeptical of a new play, because, you know, when you do a new play, you never know what you're going to get. Kids get very excited to audition for, say, Legally Blonde or Rent, because it had all this hype, and, you know, they'd heard the music, they could sing it in their sleep. I think the kids didn't know what to expect, and I think they were really surprised in a good way, because they knew us as their teachers. They were so touched that a musical of that sort of caliber in terms of the musical writing and stuff they would like was written really for them. And a lot of these kids, you know, we knew, even though we auditioned them and we didn't know who was going to be what part, in some cases we kind of had an idea just because we know our kids so well. I think as we were writing, you know, we were still writing as we were rehearsing the play. So a lot of it was written for their personalities, and they would say to each other something like, oh my God, that's so, you guys, you're acting, you're like so Hiroko or something, because this girl who plays Hiroko, which is a nerdy character, like she said something really nerdy, and she's, and they're like, oh my God, that's so Hiroko. And they would joke about it, you know? And every single night during the world premiere, when we got to the part where they found out Sadako passed away, the friends, it got extremely emotional, and they were real. I mean, there were real tears every night. It's kind of like watching the original cast of Rent or In the Heights, or which I had the pleasure of seeing, because the people in these casts genuinely create these roles and they feel such a connection to them. And so the sadness that came out of it was just organic. Because of that, it was just more, it was more powerful because the message was uplifting rather than the opposite.
Does all of these reasons about the uplifting message and the play being adamant explain why this is not a kid's play, but rather an adult musical for kids?
Yeah, I think so. I think, for example, I know that my inner child is still there. And as long as you're being true to your child's self and you're, you know, as an adult, you will always be able to relate to the things that are going on in this play. Like, as you said, bullying, self-identity, realizing too late, you know, that you've lost a friend and that you can't get her back and you can't get that time back. So I think any adult could relate to that. It's the play doesn't, it's not like Little Einstein or, you know, or, you know, a cartoon. It's, it really deals with issues that kids and adults can relate to. And because of, as we, you know, we were talking about before, because of the music and the deep emotion and, you know, the stuff that these kids are forced to grapple with at such a young age, I think that keeps it very real. And, you know, you can experience that at age 12 or you can experience that at age 30. It, you know, there's no telling when you will have to deal with that in your life, whether it be for yourself or a friend or a family member. And so I do think that this play and this, you know, the sort of current of terminal illness or that, you know, dealing with a friend that's, you know, you're not sure if you're going to have in a year. I think that's something that anybody can relate to, whether or not they've been through an experience like that.
So when's the play going to run?
Well, it runs from September 18th and 19th in Los Angeles. And that is going to be our North American premiere. And we just had an encore run of performances on Oahu, and it went extremely well. And we had Sadako's brother in town, and he saw it. And this took place on the actual 70th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there was a lot of sort of press surrounding it, and a lot of people came to see it as it kind of took place during those commemorative events. And we didn't expect Sadako's brother to have the reaction he did. We thought, you know, we're so happy that he's coming and he's making an appearance and he's going to hear the show. But my gosh, like he, after the show, he took Shayna, the girl who plays Sadako, into his arms and just started bawling, and he called her Sadako. So I guess she did her job, you know, and she, you know, she really pulled off the role. So it was, and he really resonated with the whole story. And I was worried the fictional elements would offend him just because they weren't true and that he knows exactly how it went. But he really felt that the fictionalized story really outlined and highlighted her message and, you know, what was so great about her.
How do our listeners get to the theater, even amongst the LA traffic?
Oh man, well, it's been a while since I've lived in LA, so I'm not really, can't tell you about the bus routes. But yeah, these performances in LA will take place on September 18th and 19th at the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center at the Aratani Theater. And tickets are available at jacc.org. And it's 35 for adults, and 35 and 25, depending on where you're sitting in the theater, and 15 for students under 17.
How do our listeners get to the theater?
Yeah, it's downtown LA. It's like in Little Tokyo. And it's in a great part of town, actually. It's really close to the Japanese American National Museum. Sort of, you know, it's a great area. There's lots of eateries and everything. So I think anybody who comes to see the show in Los Angeles will have a really nice time in general. So downtown is pretty central for a lot of people. So hopefully a lot of people will come and see it.
Is the musical audio described?
You know, that's a really good point. And I hadn't, you would think I would have thought about that, right?
Yep.
And we hadn't talked about that, but, you know, actually I'm having a meeting with them today so I can talk about audio description. But I would have to tell you that, and maybe this is just a product of being the lyricist, and a lot of it you can figure out without even having to see anything. There's not a whole lot of visual stuff that the audience wouldn't get, because the emotional, or the arc of the story and the plot, a lot of it takes place during the songs, and a lot of that stuff that happens, if you couldn't hear what the kids were saying, you wouldn't know what's going on. So it's the storytelling is really done by the kids. You don't have to worry about seeing a whole lot of blocking. There may be one or two things, but other than that, and even those two things are audible. Like there's a scene where you can hear tearing paper, and the audience will know exactly what that means. So all you have to do is really listen very carefully to what the kids are singing and what they're saying. And even sighted people have told me that it's all about the story and the lyrics. It's a very simple set. There are projections, but I think in terms of like what's going on stage, you won't need a whole lot of audio description for it.
Before we go, could you sing one of the songs from the musical for us?
Oh, this is the title song.
If you had just one wish, what do you think it would be? If it could be life-changing, a thought you'd only dream. A door once closed now opens. Suddenly you're free to choose your destination. Unlikely as it seems, you'll fly, no boundaries in sight. You'll soar, and with all of our might, we will dance, we will sing, and the world will hear the ring from the bell toll that's all of our words. You'll be the voice they can't hear. They'll see all our pain and our fears. Let us dance, let us sing. You will write peace on your wing, and you will fly all over the world.
And it sounds a whole lot better when you hear a young Sadako singing it.
Fabulous, fabulous. Bravo, Lori. Well, you continue to inspire us all. You continue to inspire us in your singing and, yes, theatrical careers. Thanks so much again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Before we go, I welcome your comments on this show. Just visit and like me on Facebook at Speaking Out for the Blind, or follow me on Twitter at Speak Out Blind or Speak Out for the Blind. That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening, and remember to speak out.
Join me, Brian McKellen, on Speaking Out for the Blind. I interview famous and inspirational blind individuals and other specialists about a wide variety of topics, providing you with the steps to achieve your dreams. Speaking Out for the Blind airs Wednesdays at 10:30 p.m. Eastern, 7:30 p.m. Pacific, and repeats every 2 hours overnight and throughout the next day. right here on ACB Radio Mainstream.